You're listening to More Perfect Marketing, the show for business owners and entrepreneurs always on the lookout for smart marketing ideas to keep their business moving forward. And now, here's your host, David Baer.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of More Perfect Marketing. My name is David Baer, and today we're going to be talking about human behavior. Now, you may have heard me talk on the podcast before about how I really love to emphasize the importance of direct response marketing, getting people to take an action around a particular offer that's put in front of them is a really effective way of using your marketing time and marketing dollars to affect an outcome with consumers. And so I often will talk about how big brands, big companies don't necessarily do that because they're focused on getting their brand name, their brand image out there a lot of the time. They're not necessarily able to track the things that we as smaller businesses need to track, right? There's a lot more waste, I believe, in larger businesses. And yet there's something that they do really, really well that most smaller businesses overlook. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. Today's guest is Michael Solomon. He's an expert in consumer behavior and has probably the most read textbooks on the subject that are available in business schools. I was going to say across the U.S., but I imagine across the globe. So, Michael, welcome.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on.
So, I don't know if I positioned that in a way that you see it, but it's certainly from the small business vantage point, something that I think is really important to understand a lot more about consumer behavior. And so I wonder if you can give us a brief introduction into your philosophy around why understanding consumers and consumer behavior is so important.
Well, sure. And if I can't convince you of that, then I've got a problem, because that's my mantra. You know, it's all about understanding the customer. And, you made the contrast between small business and big business, which is certainly legitimate. But in both cases, if you don't understand your customer's needs, you can't meet those needs. And that's what, you know, in Marketing 101, we teach that marketing is about satisfying needs. And so the study of your customers is really just a way of trying to get to know what those needs are so that you can basically design your business around that, you know. And you were talking about direct response and so on, and I certainly agree with that, you know. But again, I'm not sure if the distinction between small and large is as important as it used to be, especially with all the tools we have available today. And, you know, and it's funny, people often say, well, I'm in a small business. I can't compete with the big guys. They've got all these resources. They have a huge marketing department. And that is true. However, a small business often has an advantage that the big ones don't have, and that is they can be more agile. And I think that's kind of what you were saying. You know, we hear a lot about agile marketing today.
Yeah.
If you're a fairly big company, maybe you're responding to customer feedback or maybe you're not. But even if you are, it's like turning a battleship, you know, whereas you've got a lot of little motorboats out there, you know, the small business owners who are able to adapt quite quickly. And they're also, you know, this personalization that you're talking about, I think that's what you're talking about, is personalizing the offer, understanding what works and what doesn't. Small businesses definitely have the advantage there, because the people who run them often actually know their customers. They actually know who they are and what, you know, what their past is and what they need. In a big company, you don't maybe have that luxury unless you have some huge, you know, a corporation as a client. But really, I guess the moral is whether you're mom and pop or whether you're a big multinational, you need to start at the end and work backwards, which means, you know, the basic marketing concept that I teach to sophomores in college and to MBAs is that you don't invent something and then ask yourself, I wonder who will buy this. You know, what you do is you you do a deep dive into your customers or people you want to be your customers, identify unmet needs, and then solve for them. And so again, the small business has some advantages, has some disadvantages, but a lot of it's frankly is just, getting out of your office and walking around and seeing what your customers are actually doing rather than reading some report about them.
Yeah, I totally appreciate that approach. There's a guy named Dan Kennedy who works in the small business marketing space, and he talks about this concept of, walk around and listen. Go if you're selling merchandise that is sold in Walmart, for example, go to Walmart, walk the aisles, see what people are doing, how they're interacting with the things on the shelf. And that makes total sense.
Yeah, exactly. You may have talked about this on the podcast before, but the whole idea of a customer journey and mapping that journey, I don't know if that's something you've gotten into. It's a very, mm-hmm. very hot topic these days. It's something we always should have been doing, but it's old wine in new bottles because some of us are doing it already. But the point is that it is definitely the thing to do, to walk a mile in your customer's shoes, wherever that mile may take you.
Sure.
And it may be unpleasant, because you discover some of the pain points that they're encountering when they try to do business with you. So, if you do nothing else, don't buy any books, don't sign up for any courses, just go out and meet your customers.
I appreciate that. I was interviewed for a summit the other day, and the first question was, what do we need to do before we invest in courses to figure out what to do? And so, I said, well, figure out who your market is and what they want. and we've talked on this show before about, one of the most highly appreciated guys in the copywriting, direct response copywriting space is a guy named Eugene Schwartz, who wrote this very well-regarded book called Breakthrough Advertising. And what does he start it with? Well, he starts it with, what is the mass desire of the audience that you are able to, sell to, that for whom you're solving a problem? And so then this speaks to exactly what you were talking about is who are they and what do they want? Don't create it until you figure that out.
Yeah. And also, a lot of times, and this happens in the biggest companies, I've seen it firsthand. It's human nature to think about the customer that we want to have rather than the customer we actually have. So sometimes I've found that, managers will give me a very complete, description of their typical customer, but it turns out it's actually a description of themselves, not necessarily the people that they're selling to. So
I appreciate that because, sometimes when we will work with a business, one of the first pieces of the process is doing a core values assessment of the leadership. And we'll often find, just to your point, that there's a disconnect between how they're marketing and how they actually see the world and what they believe. And I think it's very useful to really look at not internally, but externally to that customer as you brought up. So I'm curious, one of the things that I was reading through a lot of stuff about the work that you've done is you have a mantra. We don't buy products because of what they do. We buy products because of what they mean. Can you give us a little bit more depth into that?
Yeah, absolutely. There's when you mentioned you used that term, that word disconnect. There's a disconnect very often between what companies sell and what people buy. And it really boils down to a very basic distinction between attributes and benefits. Everybody knows this when you tell it to them, but it's often worth reminding people that, as we like to say, a company can sell a 3/4-inch drill bit, but a customer buys a 3/4-inch hole. And that benefit is not the same thing. And furthermore, you know, whether you're in a service business or you make a tangible product, there are probably a lot of people who can provide a similar benefit, but do it in a very different way. And so if you only focus on the functionality of what you're delivering, say it's financial consulting or something like that, you're really losing sight of what people want to purchase from you, which might be, for example, financial security or peace of mind. And there's often a gulf between those two things. And, you know, so when you ask a marketer what they're selling, and if they tell you, you know, something the equivalent of a 3/4-inch drill bit, you better turn around and run, because they're not really understanding from the customer's perspective what it is that they're purchasing. And what they're purchasing is value, but it has to be value that is relevant to who they are and what they need in their lives. And so much of building product desire for a product or service, not just awareness of that product or service, is linking it to higher order needs. That is not easy to do, but if you can't do that, you're destined to be a commodity. And that's probably not where you want to be. You want to be highly differentiated, again, not just in terms of functionality, but what people are going to walk away with.
So I know you're an academic, but I also know that you live in the real world, working with real companies as a consultant on a lot of this stuff. And so I wonder if you can help translate what you just described to us by giving us a few examples that we might recognize.
Well, I can try. Sure. You know, let's see what comes to mind. One project that I really enjoyed, and this is kind of more about walking a mile in your customer's shoes. We did a project with a very large tool manufacturer and household tools and things like that. And basically what we found is they had a product that was doing okay, not great. It was a home cleaning product. And simply by going out and actually watching the people who were using this product, following them around while they actually used it, not just asking them about it after the fact, we were able to pretty quickly identify a fairly small design change that would make that product much, much easier to use. Now, the engineers who developed this product hadn't really thought about that, because they were thinking strictly in terms of the functionality of, you know, how can I get this surface as clean as possible? But they weren't really thinking about the usage of the product. And so by making that small change, you know, that product today is actually a bestseller.
And so did you make a change in how you were presenting the product to the consumer as well?
No, in that case, it was just a design change that really simplified their lives. But, you know, in other cases, it goes a lot deeper than that. So, you know, I've done a lot of work. For example, I did at one point in my life with Levi Strauss. And I had the opportunity to really do a deep dive on the meanings, the really important meanings that we attach even to a fairly mundane product like a pair of blue jeans. Now today, you know, blue jeans are, you know, becoming pretty expensive, almost like luxury products. But, you know, just even a simple pair of blue jeans, the amount of meaning that gets put into that. Of course, a lot of that is coming at us from popular culture, you know, James Dean wearing the jeans, or, you know, there's lots of products like that have these very strong cultural attachments. Harley Davidson would be another example. And understanding that, you know, and again, when I say this, probably most listeners will say, yeah, that's true. You know, when you buy a pair of pants, you're not buying just a piece of denim. You're buying something that's making a statement about yourself.
Well, so you brought up blue jeans, and I'm thinking about the wide range of products that are out there, and the cost for production probably doesn't vary very much from the cheapest thing that you can buy at Costco or Old Navy to, you know, some luxury brand that I don't even know what they are, because I don't, you know, I don't live in that space.
Right.
But they mean something different to the different consumers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. That's a really good point. I'm glad you said that, because it really underscores the issue of what we're buying when we buy a brand. And what we're buying, by and large, is a story. We're not buying the functionality. We're assuming that the functionality is there. And the reality is, and everybody's going to come up with exceptions to this, but mm-hmm. The reality is that for the most part, the stuff that we buy, at least here in the US, is probably going to work fairly well. And when you put several brands in front of consumers, within the same category, this drives managers crazy, because we all believe that whatever we sell is wonderful, but when you say to consumers, well, here's five brands in this category, which one is better than the rest? The typical answer is they're all pretty much the same. Nothing makes a marketer more crazy than hearing that. But having said that, there's often one or two brands in a category that are head and shoulders above the rest. And they are the iconic brands in that category. They're your usual suspects: Apple, Nike, Lululemon, all those. Mm-hmm. And I think that the reason they're so successful is because of the story that they're telling. And it's a story that people want to be a part of. So people aren't just buying a pair of, athletic shoes. They're buying Michael Jordan and all of, everything that goes into that. And if you look across different categories, you usually see, and this has actually been documented by research, that the first one or two brands in a category are tend to dominate the market, and the rest fight for the rest of the market share.
When you say the first, you mean the first out of the gate,
in terms of market share?
Okay.
In terms of market share, the first, the top one or two in a category tend to really dominate the market. And that's because they've made a great product.
Yeah.
Thanks to the engineers, but thanks to the marketers, that is what a brand is. A brand, we talk about brand equity, which is a financial kind of metric. Basically, how much are people willing to pay for a branded version of a product versus the generic version of that same product? And so to the extent that your customers are willing to, pay, I don't know what it is, they're willing to pay $1 for a generic version, but for your version, they're going to pay $2. Then we can say you have 100% brand equity. And that goes directly to the balance sheet. That's basically how marketers can justify their existence, is the ROI that you can get on a really strong brand. Mm-hmm. Can be quite impressive. Now, getting to that point is easier said than done, but that's what marketing should be doing.
Now, it's interesting you said the first and second in a category, and it immediately, what sprung to mind for me was the beneficial position of being second. And there's a famous example of that in the rental car industry.
Yes.
with Avis, but that you can actually leverage the fact that you're not the first in one way or another in your marketing, whereas if you're the leader, it may be more difficult. Any thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's basically just an example of what I was just saying, because if, when you think about Avis and that, and, many of your listeners may not remember that campaign. I don't know, you and I have some snow on the roof. We remember that campaign about being number two, being the underdog. That's the story. That's their brand story. So that's exactly what I was saying.
Yeah.
They're turning a negative into a positive, but they're doing it by telling a story about the famous underdog of being, being second to Hertz in that category. The similar around the same time, maybe created by the same agency, was the Volkswagen campaign that did something very similar. Mm-hmm. It basically made a virtue out of not being a, fancy sports car or something like that. That's Volkswagen's brand story.
Yeah, that was Ogilvy and Mather. I don't know who did the Avis ads, but yeah, it was around the same period as well. And it's the stuff that we do tend to geek out on here, because it's all around copywriting and market positioning. So you brought to mind a few things about self-identity as you were talking about some of these things. When I went off to college, I bought my first computer, you know, through the college. And, you know, this was, I don't even recall being given an option. But if I was given an option, the automatic, my eye went to Apple as the product that I was going to be buying, right? Because I had already sort of developed an association with it. Mm-hmm. I live in Portland, Oregon. You mentioned Nike, which is, you know, right here. And there are two vehicles that if you are a resident of Portland, Oregon, you are likely associated with. One is one that I think you know well, which is Subaru. And another one is the Prius model of Toyota, right?
Okay.
And it says something about us as consumers that we gravitate toward these things. And I'm curious if you can, because I know there's a psychological element to it. If you can help explain sort of how consumers behave in this aspect, that, you know, somebody can come into a town like mine and immediately make that association. Oh yeah, you're Portlanders. You drive one of those vehicles.
And you're weird.
Yes, we got that too.
It's weird. Yeah, well, that, again, that gets to the heart of why people buy a lot of things that they buy. You know, you put your finger on it. And, you know, I can summarize it by saying another mantra that I have, which is that we are what we buy and we buy what we are. You know, so much when I was talking about these brand meanings and not buying functionality, so much of that relates to our self-identity, or I should say identities, because we have multiple identities. And that's where it gets really complicated, but interesting. So a lot of the purchases that we make, and again, research has supported this. I'm not just spouting this. People are looking for brands that basically we look at brands in very similar ways that we look at other people. We form relationships with brands. We have love affairs with some brands. We hate some brands. You know, why is my computer out to get me? You know, we have all kinds of relationships that look a lot like the relationships people form with other people. And in fact, when you ask people to describe what we call the brand personality, which is so crucial, they will often use adjectives like sophisticated, elegant, funny, down to earth, what have you. You're a copywriter, you get it. And those are the same terms they would use to describe their next door neighbor, right? So the key in a lot of cases, again, is not focusing on the steak, it's focusing on the sizzle, in the sense that you need to show people how your brand is going to be really sync with either who I am now or somebody that I want to be. So when we talk about aspirational marketing and showing people a more ideal version of their lifestyle, even if that is something that the media has just invented, that's a different conversation. Mm-hmm. But that, you know, that is really what motivates a lot of people. And you know, as I tell my undergrads, a lot of advertising follows a very, very simple formula. It's like a makeover that you get at a department store. Here's who you are now. Here's who you want to be. Our brand is the bridge that will get you from here to here. It's that simple. And so it really is like a makeover, or kind of a before and after. So to the extent that you can help people visualize themselves using that product, and now they're attaining things that they couldn't attain before: professional success, athletic success, dating success, whatever the sphere of life is, that's the role that products are playing. So to think of them just as these things that are lying around our house or our garage or our office, you're really making a big mistake, because products really are almost in a mystical way, they're almost alive. And we often do impute magical properties to products, that, you know, they can magically, that's certainly what advertising built upon, right? They can magically make us more glamorous or more successful.
Which reminds me of one last copywriter I'll mention, and that's John Carlton, who talks a lot about the way that you sell to somebody is you give them the idea that they're going to buy this thing, go to sleep, and magically the next day wake up and have whatever problem they had that, you know, when they made the purchase solved because they made that investment. And I love the way that you positioned the product or service being the vehicle to achieve an outcome. I think that's beautiful.
And I love, you know, one quotation I love is from Charles Revson, who's the founder of Revlon. Mm-hmm. And he said something to the effect of, in the factory, we make cosmetics. In the store, we sell hope.
Yes. Yeah, I remember seeing that quote as well. Yeah. Michael, our time is up, but I want to make sure folks know that you are reachable. And you are out, I'm assuming, still doing speaking and consulting work and all of that. Where can they find out more about what you're doing and how they can get a hold of you?
Yeah, well, thank you. My website is michaelsolomon.com. That's three O's, like the king, King Solomon, michaelsolomon.com. And my email is simply michael@michaelsolomon.com. Or you can find me on LinkedIn. And for what it's worth, my latest book is called The New Chameleons, How to Connect with Consumers Who Defy Categorization.
That's one I'm going to be investing some time into, because that's a challenge that I think many of us marketers have. And I can't wait to find out what your solutions are.
Well, thanks. Yeah. And I'm by chameleons, what I mean is that we change our colors very frequently, in the sense we're talking about these identities. That's what I mean by chameleons. We're today, in today's society, as opposed to say 30, 40 years ago, each of us is constantly experimenting with new ways to think about ourselves and the brands and the products that we need to make those selves a reality.
Excellent. I'm going to be seeking that book out. And for folks who are interested in reaching out to you, michaelsolomon.com. We'll make sure to leave a link to that in the show notes as well. Michael Solomon, thank you so very much for joining me. This has been a fun conversation.
Well, likewise. Thank you, David. I really enjoyed it.
Indeed. Folks, you have been listening to another episode of More Perfect Marketing. Thanks for hanging out with us. And I hope to see you back here again real soon. Take care.
You have been listening to More Perfect Marketing. For a collection of 26 smart marketing cheat sheets to help you master your marketing, please visit getdavidsgift.com. That's getdavidsgift.com. Once again, thanks for listening to More Perfect Marketing.